welcome to Worlds Apart. More than a century since Rudyard Kipling extolled the white man's burden and equated colonization to a civilizing effort, the skin color of its modern adherents may have been diluted, but the ethos is still more or less the same. The West still sees itself as the shining city on a hill whose values, practices, and interests need to be bestowed on those living at the foot of that hill. For all the talk about equality, can the so-called international community ever part ways with the idea that some nations know what's best for the rest? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Chris Isiki, director of the African Center for the Study of the United States at the University of Pretoria. Professor Isiki, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Good day, and thank you for having me on your show.
Now, the white man's burden is such an easy issue, and it's, I think, it's very easy to fall into propaganda here. And this is exactly what Moscow has been accused of when the Russian president suggested that Western hegemony is a new form of colonialism. You are more than 12,000 kilometers away from Moscow in Pretoria, and yet I've seen you make not an exact, but a somewhat similar point. You said that the Russian war in Ukraine is a product of the racist international system. What do you mean by that?
Look, it's a racist international system if you go back to its origin in terms of, you know, the modern state system. The Westphalian Treaty that introduced the state systems as we know them. And that's the idea, you know, behind, you know, the system, that's the formation of the system, the state system, was based on a racist ontology of beings, you know, with Europeans at that time as beings deserving of human rights and the privileges that go, with such rights as heralded by the European Enlightenment age. On the other hand, non-Westerners, we're talking about Africans, we're talking about Arabs, Asians, Caribbean peoples, Latin Americans, and even the Slavs at some point, were regarded as the non-beings who did not expect to enjoy, you know, the privileges, the benefits and rights that's the international system, so to say, put in place by Western Europe at the time, they were not expected to enjoy it. And for me, this is how I view, the different approaches, you know, to similar conflicts. As we see in the United Nations approach to the genocide in Rwanda in 1994, as about the same time the Bosnia-Herzegovina war was in, we saw, you know, the United Nations responding differently, so that's what I mean by that racist international system that builds a racist ontology of beings versus non-beings, with one side as beings and the other as not.
Can I ask you here, where do you think the Russians fall within this spectrum of beings versus non-beings? Because on the one hand, we are white, and we for a long time wanted to believe that we are part of the Western civilization, but historically for many centuries, it's pretty clear that the rest of the West considered us as sort of semi-barbarians, if not full-time barbarians.
Well, like I said, it was the West versus the rest, however you want to look at it. But for me, if you ask me directly, if I want to speak honestly, where Russia falls, look, in terms of the coloniality of power, Russia falls well within that prism of one of the powerful states that in some ways is a colonizer. Russia doesn't have the colonial baggage in Africa, and this is one of the factors that drive anti-West sentiments in Africa.
And by the way, Russia has always supported the liberation struggle, not only for political reasons, but also for, you know, spiritual and ideological reasons, because it truly believed that, it comes from a different understanding of how you deal with diversity.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I said Russia doesn't have that baggage in Africa. Well, it doesn't mean that Russia does not have the colonial baggage in terms of how it has related with its neighbors historically.
Now, the reason I'm asking about this is because if I understood your thesis correctly, let me know if I was wrong here. You believe that the inequality of this international system rests primarily within the UN Security Council and its veto powers, which, according to you, permit some countries to become rich and powerful and preserve that privilege on the back of exploiting others. And I think that accurately describes the Western approach to the world over a couple of centuries. But is it equally true about Russia and China? Because I do believe that these two countries have, who are also UN Security Council members and who use veto powers, they have a somewhat different approach to how they deal with other nations, big and small.
Yeah, they do have a different approach, but at the end of the day, the result is the same for the countries of lesser power that it relates with. If you talk about China, for example, it may use a different tactics, but at the end of the day, if Africa's foreign policy is to be controlled or impacted by China's economic dealings with the continent, then at the end of the day, it is about control, it's about power. Ultimately, this game is about power. And this is where, at some point, the lines between black and white, Westerner or Easterner, becomes a bit blurred. Because at that table where powerful countries sit, racism doesn't count. Racism only becomes an instrument for achieving that power. So ultimately, if you look at it from a power point of view, from a coloniality of power point of view, then you can begin to also use that lens to interrogate China, use that lens to interrogate Russia. And I say this because these three countries, the United States, Russia, and China, are the biggest superpower competitors in Africa currently, and that's my interest, Africa.
But Professor Isikia, I think it was one of the Indian liberation heroes who said that power is not given, it's taken. You may put the onus on the great powers, but isn't it also within the recipients of their policies to, you know, ask for a more dignified or more fair treatment? I mean, does it really make sense to blame Russia, China, or the United States, for that matter, if the countries are ready to stay in a somewhat passive position?
No, I agree with you completely. It doesn't make sense to blame them. And that's why I don't do the blame game. I actually, like, if I want to talk about Russia's war in Ukraine, I don't want to talk about who's to blame between Russia and the US, because that's not the real issue. So you are correct that it's not useful to blame. And this is why I'm saying that it's a pity. It's a shame that despite Africa's vast oil resources, Africa still depends on Russia, Saudi Arabia, for oil. Despite its arable land, agricultural land across the continent, it's still the biggest importer of wheat from Russia and Ukraine. This is unacceptable. So if Africa doesn't put its house in order, organize itself politically, starting with the perverse state systems that it inherited from colonialists. If it doesn't sit down and put its ass together, it will not be forced to reckon with. It will not be handed any kind of privilege or power. I'm not saying, therefore, that you have to take that power by force. You have to take that power by organizing yourself properly so that you can earn the respect of the international system rather than always going happy hand begging for all kinds of aids.
I want to go back to something you wrote, and you said that in this unequal international system with the UN Security Council at its center, the system allows powerful countries to break international law without any consequence, be it Russia and Ukraine or the United States in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and a very long list of other countries. Is it really fair and just to put Russia and the United States on the same moral footing here? Because Russia is not fighting on the other side of the globe for some corporate interest. This is a very direct, very immediate, very visceral struggle for us. And we see that as a struggle for our own independence, not for the Ukrainian land, not against the Ukrainian people, but against Western efforts to militarize our neighbor and to turn it into a hostile state against us. Is it fair to equate Russia and America here?
Well, it's a matter of you know, you if you want to talk in terms of volumes, then I can reason with you in terms of saying perhaps on this particular point, the United States has you know defied international order more than Russia has. But I am
but
a
it's
Christian,
not about comparisons; it's about vital interests. The United States hasn't fought on its territory. We are fighting on our border and in the territories that historically not only belong to the Russian land, but also host Russian people.
Well, that's one way to look at it. But another way to look at it also in terms of why I've put Russia in that category is what Russia did in Syria, okay? That was not a direct threat.
And what did it do in Syria? It protected the state structures against the terrorist onslaught. Did it
well, not? Well, the terrorist onslaught, how do you define terrorists? It depends on who's defining terrorists, right?
Well, I define them as people who use indiscriminate violence. And I was in Syria back in 2012, 2013, and I've seen the corpses of, you know, 5-year-old children who were killed because, you know, of their parents' religious or ethnic background or because their parents worked for the government. I mean, I don't think there is much room for argument here. Sure, there were some civil rights organizations there, but they didn't carry weapons.
Well, look, for me, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. So it depends on where you're looking at it from. I've also done that by looking at the role of the Wagner group in the Sahel of Africa, which in many ways, of course, the Wagner group is a private militia, but has been said to have close links with the Russian government. Just yesterday, I saw the head of the group, contesting for who's doing better between the Russian army and themselves in recovering Russian ground in parts of eastern Ukraine. So for me, of course, I agree with you that there is an existential threat to consider in the case of Russia's aggression in Ukraine. But one could also push back and say that is this war in Ukraine really about an existential threat to Russia or Russia's or Vladimir Putin's need for recognition in an international system where he wants to get as big a sphere of influence as Russia, as the USSR used to have during the Cold War era?
Professor Isiki, we have to take a very short break, but let's keep that last question in mind and we will return to it just after a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Putin is on offense. Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Весело тут. Тихо летит. Куда полетело?
Брызги, которые тут есть, это брызги от своеобразной волны.
На сегодняшний день водохранилище сработано до мертвого объема, так называемого.
С водой у нас просто ужас.
Мне 70 лет, я уже не могу тягать вот эти баклажки.
Я увидел бабушка, которая шла с пустыми баклажками. Я сказал папе, что когда вырасту, буду находить воду и развозить людям.
Я говорю, хорошо, сынок, завтра начнем, без проблем. Рекорд был 27 бочек.
Если сбой в подаче воды, то это угроза для жизни больного.
Pour couper l'eau à tout simplement à la population du Донбасс. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Chris Isiki, director of the African Center for the Study of the United States at the University of Pretoria. Professor Isiki, just before the break, we got to the issue of what are Russia's or Vladimir Putin's motives in Russia's military incursion into Ukraine, and you suggested that it's his search for recognition. Don't you think that there were plenty of other ways that the West would grant to Vladimir Putin of recognition or of anything if he actually towed the American line?
Well, I don't think that if you look at American politics, I don't think that any president, not even especially the last one before Biden, had the audacity, okay, to actually poke Russia in the eye or stand true to Russia on issues. Not one.
What do you mean, not one? But if you look at the American budgetary expenses and the scale of militarizing, I mean, sending weapons, sending trainers, military trainers to Ukraine, it's all public record. And, you know, the count is in billions.
I'm not trying to defend what the U.S. have done in terms of trying to encourage, Ukraine. One of the things that we have not talked about, in my view, about this particular conflict in terms of looking at where who's responsible for the current crisis, is the will of the Ukrainian people themselves, all right? The Ukrainian people, if they do not want the line that was told by their president, the president that was overwhelmingly elected by over 73% of the electorate, if they did not like the line he was told about, you know, and securing Ukraine's autonomy from Russia, especially when you consider Russia's historical a track record of invading Ukraine dating back to the 1700s, right?
Well, wait a second. I'm not aware of Russian historical record of invading Ukraine. In fact, the Ukrainian territory has grown substantially during Soviet times. But I also want to add that the mandate of President Zelensky was in part secured on his promise not only giving autonomy to Ukraine. Russia was never questioning the sovereignty of Ukraine, but he also promised peace with the eastern regions, which were shelled for 7 consecutive years by the Ukrainian military. I mean, let's be accurate on the historical front here.
Yeah, I'm accurate. And I'm telling you that the first invasion of Ukraine by Russia was in 1783.
What do you define as invasion then?
One invasion is invasion. When you invade a country with your forces and try to annex the states, and if you like, that is another form of direct colonialism, But that's not the point I'm even trying to make. If you know what I'm saying is that we must also ask the question of why Ukraine feels the need to seek protection from NATO against Russia. That's a legitimate question.
To switch gears a little bit, I want to sort of bring in African experience here as well, because South Africa is no stranger to the use of force and violence for political reasons. And I'm sure you're well aware that the person who is justly celebrated as the father of your nation, Nelson Mandela, was once on the U.S. terrorist list for precisely what we would now recognize as the liberation struggle. I think most people of goodwill, if not all people of goodwill, absolutely despise the use of force, the use of violence for political purposes. But in the world that we live in, the world as we know it today, could that be fully excluded, especially with the self-proclaimed leader of this world using force, military force, so liberally? Are there any other ways for the countries to ensure their interest as an ultimate measure? I'm not saying that this has to be an issue of first resort, but if push comes to shove, isn't that what South Africa and most countries around the world maintain their military force for?
Yes, absolutely. And that's why South Africa has taken a position of resorting to dialogue, multilateralism as a way of solving the problem. In fact, the neutrality that we saw in many African countries' stance in the U.S. security vote in March which many scholars have tended to see as leaning towards Russia. And one of the things that I've also jotted the U.S. Out of its neglect of Africa after the Cold War is the fact that, people are seeing that as a form of negation of the UAE, the African Union's, principle of the inviolability of territorial border, territorial integrity, the resource to peaceful means to resolve conflict. So people have said that Africa's neutrality, the neutrality of some African states during that vote, was in way of violating its own principles of neutrality. But of peaceful resolution of conflict. But South Africa has been very strong in maintaining that it seeks, peaceful ways to resolve this conflict and using multilateral agency as much as possible. And I think that that's a very good point to stand on, because it's a principle of the African Union itself.
And I've also seen you write that this conflict, as tragic and ugly as it may be, may also force the international system into much delayed reforms. And in fact, this neutrality that you mentioned of the African countries and many others, countries that refuse to subject themselves to sometimes very heavy American pressure and sometimes outright blackmail by the American officials, isn't that also a sign of a slight change that, other countries, non-superpowers are not demanding something from quote-unquote big guys, but actually recognizing their own importance and the importance of taking a stance and the importance of pursuing their own interests?
The, like I said, there's a silver lining in this conflict, and it's in the silver lining is for reforming the current international system as we have it, because it's not going to sustain as it is currently. And I we must recognize that every country of course has its interest. But the COVID-19 pandemic, for example, has shown us that the world is, interdependent. We are interconnected in many ways. And the kind of philosophy, foreign policy philosophy of Ubuntu, that which South African foreign policy is built on, is the interconnectivity of all of humanity. So even though we talk about these individual national interests, we must also be at some point articulate a global interest. And what is that global interest? And every state is important, especially Africa with its population and its resources, and one should have a seat in the table in determining what that global interest is going to be, and also in decision making around enforcement of rules and regulations to govern that international system.
And I think you would agree with me that the formulation of this global agenda also presupposes, the realization of the spirit of Ubuntu that you are talking about. It presupposes that countries, regardless of their size or power, treat each other as moral equals. And I've heard that a lot from African thinkers and African leaders suggesting that, for example, the United States needs to change its approach to Africa and it needs to treat Africans fairly, with dignity, as equal partners, rather than somebody who needs to be told what to do or needs to be twisted into serving the American understanding of the bilateral relationship. My question to you, as somebody who studies the United States professionally and over time, do you think the U.S. bureaucracy is philosophically, ontologically capable of treating anyone as equal? And wouldn't that then mean that they will have to part ways with this very attractive but ultimately supremacist idea of the shining city on a hill that has to bestow its light on all of us, the rest of us, and enlighten?
Well, look, the orientation is changing right now. And, one of the things that interests me in their new Africa policy is the notion of seeing and dealing with Africa as equal partners. That's something that it's new.
What does it mean? Because it's a beautiful phrase, but what does it mean in practice? Equal partners.
Well, for me, the starting point is having that phrase, and that phrase is in the document. It's ground for Africa to hold the United States to account in terms of giving that phrase a living meaning. So in terms of recognizing Africa's agency in terms of, not just giving it, but allowing Africa to take part in discussions that determine its interests, that determine its future, right?
So you're talking about allowing somebody to even take part in the discussions, not even following the decisions that follow from that discussion, but simply, you know, having a seat at the table. Isn't that a little bit too modest to ask for?
When it is modest, but do we as Africa have the structures in place to actually make useful meaning of the opportunity presented? You know, for example, I wrote a piece recently about why it is important for Africa to study the United States as well. And this is what we are doing at our center. We are trying to understand the United States as a nation and as a society, not just its politics, but in totality because of its connections, cultural connections, economic and political connections with Africa. But I'm saying that we need to replicate centers like mine across the entire continent so that we can develop a template for dealing with the United States, so that we can have an Africa-US policy rather than a US-Africa policy. All right?
Professor Isiki, this is a great idea, but for example, in Russia and China, there are many of such centers. They know the United States pretty well. But I think the difference between their approach and the African approach is that they not only formulate their policy, but they try to stand their ground and defend their interests. And the United States doesn't like that at all. When push comes to shove, when their interests are involved, they are not ready. I mean, they rhetorically, they are always ready to treat you as an equal partner. But when it comes to their interests, they hardly ever compromise. My last question to you is, do you think the United States practically is capable of treating anyone, any peer, let's say Russia, China, the European Union, or let's say India or South Africa, as a practical equal, as somebody whose interests need to be not only talked about, but respected, security interests, economic interests, human interests, etc.?
Well, look, my answer is that it is capable of doing that. The United States does not, even though it is a superpower, does not have the capability, okay, to police the entire world, especially given the kind of new forms of conflict, new forms of insecurity, human insecurity that is developing all over the world. The United States also has its own weaknesses within itself. All right. So it does not pretend anymore to be this shining, perfect developed state. It recognizes that it needs allies, and it is not going to bamboozle its way by force or threat of force as it used to do before. And for me, a starting point, like I said, would be testing its current policy towards Africa. And I think that is only fair to give them time to see how that plays out. If in a year or two from now, we're able to sit down and look at the policy in terms of implementation, expanding the promises that have been made to African leaders in the Washington, Africa Leaders Summit that held in Washington in December, we will do a post-mortem of all of this and then answer that question more fairly. But for now, the fact that there's a movement, there's a shift towards recognizing African agency, for example, as equal partners, we would see how that moves from words to action and then judge.
We have to leave it there. I really appreciate your time today with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.